You're listening to BQN. Assimilate the audio.
Welcome, listeners, to another episode of All Good Things, a Star Trek Universe podcast here on BQN. I'm your host, Mark White, and with me today, yes, we've got Christos back this week. Hey, Christos.
Hello, hello, hello. How you doing, Mark?
Doing so good. I am so excited to talk to you. I know you were on a mission last week, and you went over to Comic-Con, so I can't wait to hear just a little bit about it. I know you went in depth this week on Infinite Diversity, but if you can distill for our listeners a little bit, that'd be awesome.
Yeah. I did get to go to Comic-Con, my first time inside Comic-Con. I've been to a lot of the surrounding things in the past. There's so much going on outside the convention center that, and you don't need to have a badge for Comic-Con. So, especially if you live here in San Diego, like I do, it's very easy to go down there and have a good time. And Star Trek always does their biggest presence outside of the convention center. So that's pretty cool. I would say it was definitely Paramount Plus promotion, Star Trek promotion was so prevalent and kind of in your face that it was really awesome as a Trek fan to see how much signage that they had. They had the whole entire sign of the Marriott there with a big Trek wrap around the building and pictures of like Lower Decks and Picard and Strange New Worlds, really promoting it. But the 10 Forward experience and the Starfleet Outpost were just delightful and a really great time. And obviously, most fans have probably seen the panels by now, and we're all aware of the big Trek news that broke that week that we were all speculating on a few weeks ago. Mm-hmm. And I dare I say it did not disappoint. I'd talk a little bit about that Picard especially here, but if you guys do want to hear a really long breakdown of an analysis of everything you saw at Comic-Con, check out this week's Infinite Diversity, where Chrissy and Thad and I really break everything down in detail. But I'll always talk about that Picard trailer and that Picard panel. So if you want to tell me what was the most exciting thing you saw in that character reveal, Mark?
Well, I think all of us were just blown away by Worf, which he looked even better than I could have possibly imagined Worf looking at this phase in his his life. Just stunning. And I also want to talk a little bit, and I haven't heard anybody else mention this, but the Geordi poster, because I'm not into like older guys really, but he was so disarmingly handsome. Especially Regal. With the blue eyes that he has. He's wearing the contacts.
The contacts, yeah. He definitely looked, kind of had a more of a regal look to him. He definitely had that, I'm a Commodore. I'm in a position of authority, and he had that distinguished, you know. Men are allowed to get more distinguished as they age, as they say. So, yeah, he definitely had that look.
So, so handsome, and I'm excited to see him finally be able to approach the character in a way that is going to make him proud as an actor, to revisit the character and address certain things that maybe he wasn't allowed to do during the TNG initial run. And I think that's the same we can say for all of the actors, especially, you know, Gates McFadden with Beverly. She said this is the best we've ever seen her. And I'm just... To me, that's really special, and I'm so looking forward to seeing what they want to bring, what them as actors want to bring to those roles.
Yeah, I think Terry Metalis had said they approached all of the main cast and said, hey, they had these sit-down discussions. Where do you see your character? What would you like to see for your character? And they did their best to incorporate that into how we see them in this upcoming season. I think Worf is going to be the most interesting. He's supposed to be... We're supposed to see some of the effects of the Dominion War that had on Worf. He doesn't sound like the happiest person with his little voice overlay talking about the sacrifices that he has made and, you know, I think we're going to see what some of those are. So I think Worf's going to be one to watch. I think Geordi surprised me. I was just kind of neutral on the idea of catching up with Geordi, but I'm actually looking forward to that now. And maybe it's because I think for Geordi and for Worf and for Crusher, those are the three people we haven't seen anything of in the Picard. Everybody else has been, I mean, Troy and Riker have been on. We had saw Data. We've obviously seen for Jean-Luc, but we have not seen those three characters. And maybe that's why it was a little bit more exciting for me. But definitely looking forward to it. I loved seeing Gates in Starfleet again. A lot of people thought she was in civilian clothes, but you had to watch that on a big TV in high def to see that that actually was a Starfleet jacket that Gates McFadden was wearing, and Deanna Troi.
She sort of hinted that her character hadn't really been in touch with everybody else in the same way that some of the other characters had stayed in touch. Like, she had been out doing her own thing. And so, to me, that brings an interesting dynamic. Like, why was she not in contact with the rest of the crew for the last, like, you know, 20 years?
Yeah.
Like, what was she up
yeah,
to?
I don't know if there's too much to read into that other than maybe she just got busy. I speculated yesterday on an Infinite Diversity, and I'll say it here. I have a feeling that she's been out as Captain Beverly Crusher on her medical vessel and, like, literally running missions, and maybe had been involved in humanitarian efforts with the Romulan fallout and maybe some of the Dominion War fallout, and trying to, you know, help, you know, nursemaid the galaxy, doing things that you would definitely expect Beverly Crusher to do. And maybe that's why she's been away, because she's been out captaining.
What was the ship that she had in All Good Things?
The Pasteur.
The Pasteur. Do you think we'll see that on screen? Do you think that'll be her ship?
You know, I love it. I did love that ship. I mean, that design kind of goes way back to some old TOS tech manuals. So I was really surprised in 1994 when we saw the Pasteur have that design. I think it was a very unique design, especially for Star Trek to go build that out for just one episode. But I did like the design. I think it would be a nice little connection to say that everything we saw in All Good Things, you know, the alternate timelines and whatnot, some of that did come true. So that would be a cool way to connect that a little bit to the finale. For me, it doesn't have to be the Pasteur. It doesn't even have to be the same design ship. I just love to have seen some growth in, you know, for the 7 years and the 4 years of the movie, the four movies, Dr. Crusher stayed a commander the entire time. Mm-hmm. And so when you think about career growth and whatnot, once you get into a show, I mean, even Riker didn't get promoted how many times for 15 years when he really should have been a captain back in season one. And so seeing our favorite characters, like you're seeing, you know, Worf became a captain, Geordi became a commodore. These people progressed in their careers. I would love to see that progression for Beverly Crusher.
Hashtag justice for Bev.
Just, I am more convinced than ever based off that panel, based off the continued tweets from Terry Metalis and whatnot, that this is definitely a justice for Beverly kind of season. So I couldn't be happier. It's almost like they're making it for me.
Same. When I was a really little kid, I think I might have mentioned this to you, my parents were busy. They weren't around much. And I'd watch Star Trek, and I would look at Beverly, and I wish she was my mom. Like, she was just, you know, present for her son and supportive of him in whatever endeavor, you know, he wanted to do. And I loved just how maternal she was, even with the crew. And I don't know, I really looked up to her. And I did get to meet her once in my life, and she just blew me away with her kindness and generosity. And I'll never forget that. She's just a really sweet person.
Yes. The character's great, and so is the actress.
Yeah.
Great person. Well, like I said, folks, if you want to hear a lot more about San Diego Comic-Con and analysis of all the trailers and the video games and the comic books that were all teased at SDCC, check out this week's Infinite Diversity.
Well, now it's time for All Good World.
From Las Vegas to Boston, USA to Canada and South America, from the United Kingdom to South Africa, from Russia to Australia, the South Pacific and beyond, this is All Good World.
Each episode, we highlight a different location around the globe where this podcast has reached. Today's episode, we'd like to give a special shout-out to Nevada, where we will be very soon. Usually I give fun facts, but I thought this would be a great opportunity to mention that Christos, Amy, myself, and a whole bunch of others from the BQN will be at STLV this year. Well, not really STLV, it'll be a kind of STLV. In Vegas, just the end of the month.
56-year mission, whatever you want to call it.
Yeah.
I can't believe you just made Nevada the All Good World on a week that Amy is not on the show. I think you're going to hear about that.
Well, I mean, you know, she's very, very busy this weekend, and she is helping her mom actually move to Nevada from Utah, so that's exciting for her in her personal life.
Awesome. Oh, I'm just teasing, but yeah, looking forward to it. We're less than 4 weeks away, so it's going to be a good time.
Yeah, it's going to be so much fun. Now, they did recently get some flooding happening in Vegas, which I was shocked. So they've had a couple of monsoon rains, and you can go online right now and you can see video of like parking garages and stuff at some of the casinos getting absolutely flooded, as well as I saw one video online somebody posted of water pouring through one of the casinos, and I was like, holy cow, like this this is unprecedented. Yeah,
I mean, Vegas is kind of in the bottom of a big valley, so to speak, and so when it rains, it doesn't take much in the desert too. You get just a couple of inches of rain and you get that runoff. So yeah, I hope everyone's staying dry in Vegas, and hopefully can get back to normal pretty fast.
Yeah, you know what that reminds me of, actually seeing the images of the rain pouring down in Las Vegas. I was reminded of this episode of Strange New Worlds where there's this planet. I believe the episode is called Children of the Comet. Yes, that's right. We're talking about it this week.
I see what you did there. I see what you did.
You have this desert-dwelling civilization, and then because of this ice chunk that falls off the comet, it actually changes the atmosphere of the planet, and so for the first time they have this heavy rain come down on these people in the middle of the desert, and for them it's like this miracle from God. Yeah, really looking forward to talking about this week's Strange New Worlds.
So should you basically introduce the concept that we're going to be talking about? It's going to be part one of our First Contact series, and the episode is Children of the Comet, Strange New Worlds, Season 1, Episode 2.
Yes! It's so exciting. The whole idea for this First Contact series came from this episode, and I don't know why, like, watching other Treks didn't pop into my head, but I watched this one, I was like, oh, yes.
Yeah.
Great idea.
Yeah. This is a really, really good episode. Like I said a moment ago, it was the second episode of the series, and I just rewatched it this morning, listeners, and it's just such a good episode. And for me, what was really jarring watching it now, after having seen the entire 10 episodes of season one, I was floored at realizing just how much character growth we had in season one, because we're back there in episode two, and I feel like we're watching much, much, much more earlier versions of Uhura and Pike and Spock and Hemmer too. And I felt as the season went, where we are in episode two and where we ended up in episode 10 was like light years of growth. And It was really just in such a short time to go back and watch that episode again. It was really telling that there is so much character growth written into this show that going back and watching episode two just stood out as a, wow, these are much more earlier versions of our characters. And it was only, you know, there's only 8 more episodes between there and the finale.
I wish we could have got like 16 episodes or something. But anyway,
you've got 10 more coming.
Thank goodness.
it's funny, we call this First Contact, but we are, the Enterprise is moving along, and we're in the Persephone system, correct?
Correct.
All right. I'm doing this synopsis, by the way, off the cuff. I'm not looking at anything. So so it's going to be a little bit fast and loose. So there is a, they are going through the Persephone system, and then there's also a comet moving through the system, and they quickly determine that the comet is on a crash course with Persephone 4, one of the Persephone planets, and it's going to smash right into it. So there is a pre-warp species on the planet, the Deleb. And basically, it will wipe out all life on the planet, and that will be the end of them. So the Enterprise sets out on a mission to use, what do they call it, ion something with the photon torpedoes to alter the course of the comet. I think this is something that science has shown is pretty common, because the solution was pretty quick. Oh, we're just going to do this, this, and that, and we're going to go do it. So when they go to fire these torpedoes, suddenly the comet puts up shields, and everyone's like, well, I didn't see that today. Come to find out, they beam down to the comet, and immediately, with the away team, which includes Uhura, Sam Kirk, La'an, and Spock. There we go. Kirk is a little gung-ho and gets injured pretty fast, and it really becomes on Uhura, who is on her first away team mission ever, to kind of, as the linguistics expert, to kind of figure out a way to communicate with the comet and with the alien technology on the comet. In the meantime, back on the Enterprise, they attempt to fire on the shields in order to get through and get the away team out, and these alien race known as the Shepherds appear, and they basically reveal that they are the protectors of the comet, who is actually the Mahani, and it's basically, they liken them to almost like godlike status of going through the universe and seeding life throughout the universe, and that from long before their time even recorded, their race has been protecting the comet, and they will not let the Enterprise interfere whatsoever with the comet. So there's a, and they are definitely superior in terms of ship speed, armament, and things like that. So the Enterprise just can't get into a battle. Cut to the Enterprise getting through it. Of course, they have a unique solution where they use the Enterprise as more of a distraction while Spock gets out on a shuttle and uses heat shielding on the shuttle to melt some of the ice of the comet, and that in turn moves the course of the comet away from the planet. And that piece of ice that broke off basically makes contact with the atmosphere of the planet and introduces rain and water to the atmosphere, which now changes the planet and makes it more, I guess we'll say, more Earth-like. And by introducing water, that will probably change the development of that species as a result. And we come to find out in the end from Uhura that based on communications and that she's now deciphered with the comet, that they knew all along what they were doing. The comet knew what it was doing. It knew it was going to miss the planet. It predicted, basically, or foretold what Spock was going to do. So it kind of jived with what the Shepherds were saying all along about the comet. So really kind of, you know, everything kind of comes together at the end. And I think this was a really strong, strong episode. It had all that, for me, it had a lot of what I like about Trek. It had action, it had a mystery, it had crew trying to science their way through things. It had an emotional appeal at the end when that rain's coming down and you see the aliens getting water. It's like everything you want to see in a Star Trek episode. Some of the side plot that this episode deals with is the introduction of the captain's dinners, and we learn a lot about Uhura's backstory, which we'll get to, and we also learn that Pike is really struggling with the visions he had in Boroth and the what his future holds for him. And that basically set up what the recurring theme for Pike all through season one. So there were elements of this episode that were very much episode of the week, and then there were elements that were the continuing storyline. So, and it like I said, it's one of my favorite episodes of the season.
Well, I know that I talked to Amy about this week's episode as well. She was sort of on the fence of whether or not she'd be able to actually join this week because she had a lot going on. So she ended up not making it, but she did mention that this was one of her favorite episodes of the first season here because she said it reminded her a lot of Discovery's previous season, with Discovery Season 4. And what she loved so much about that was that the optimism, the meeting new species we've never seen before, and bringing that element of just working together and communication and finding a solution for problems that don't involve necessarily like big fights, you know, that you can come to a diplomatic resolution with people that you might not necessarily agree with. And yeah, I see all of that in this episode, and you know, I agree with Amy. That's one of the things that makes this like a really good Trek episode.
Right. And shout out to math and music being the universal language that becomes the key to communicating with Mahani and solving the mystery of this week's episode.
Yeah. Well, you know, this is a great introduction to the First Contact series because we have this unique opportunity to have First Contact in an episode of Star Trek with three different species. Now, our heroes, you know, in the Federation don't necessarily make physical contact with all three. However, as an audience, we do get to see for the first time three different new species. And I love that they did that, and I love how organic it is. The first species that we actually meet right at the opening is the Dalib, and we find out they're a pre-warp species. And I loved seeing them. I thought that their little the hut village in the desert looked cool. I wish that our heroes would have been able to meet them because they seemed so cool. But I'm hoping that maybe they bring them back in Discovery, because it's so many thousands of years later, maybe at that point they'd have warp technology and we can revisit them. Do you think that they'd be able to do that, or would?
I think that is definitely plausible. I mean, if you think about how far humans came in 1,000 years, you know, definitely we could see them there. Yeah, General Order 1 prohibits Pike's team with making contact, but yeah, Discovery or even in the Picard world now, you're about 130 years down the road, roughly. You know, who knows where they could have gotten 130 years. Maybe that might be too soon, but Discovery is definitely 1,000 years later. So that's, yeah, I would say, totally on the table.
They could have a Who Watches the Watchers moment and still be like down there and like watching them, but in, you know, sort of a cloaked outpost or something.
Because those missions never go wrong.
Oh, no, no.
If you have a duck blind, something's going to happen.
If we learned anything from Star Trek, it's that, you know, the duck blinds, they always fail.
Yep. Something happens, because otherwise we wouldn't have an episode.
Well, the Mahanit would be, I guess, the next creature that we meet. It's a comet.
Entity.
Yeah, it's an entity. It's a comet, but it's a god. I found it interesting that the shepherds referred to it as him, but also it, depending on what they were saying.
Couple hundred years in the future, and we still can't get our pronouns right.
Right. Well, they also mentioned that there was more than one, and that their species had been following them for quite some time. And I think that's why their ships were so big. Talking about the shepherds, to me, their ships, you know, definitely look generational. It looked like they'd been added on by time.
I was just going to use that word, generation ship, which we hear a lot in sci-fi.
Well, the ship also to me looked like Babylon 5.
You know, as someone who never watched Babylon 5, I at least knew enough to know what it looked like. I had the exact same thought. So I don't think you're alone in that. And maybe that was a little bit of a intentional homage, potentially. Mm-hmm. I don't know.
Anytime I can rope in other sci-fi, because, you know, this is all good things, and that includes all good sci-fi. And I think it's fun for our listeners, too.
Definitely. Yeah, I like the Shepherds. I like what they stood for. They did mention that they don't even know how long they've been the Shepherds of Mahani. And so they're just kind of cruising around protecting it. And they also mentioned that there's still, like you said, more of these types of comets and life forms out there, arbiters of life, seeding life in the galaxy, but there are very few left.
So do you think that the Mahanit, well, the glowing egg thing, was that the Mahanit? I get the impression that it was, and
yeah, definitely.
That it was conscious.
Definitely, and Uhura and Spock were definitely communicating. I kind of felt like one of the stupid things of the episode, not stupid, but like the Shepherds felt like they knew so much, but Uhura figured out a lot in a very short period of time, to the point that obviously she made peace with them and got them to lower the force field. And that's how I read that, as once she learned the right frequency and notes to sing, it calmed Mahani and it dropped its defenses. And that if Uhura figured that out in an hour and the Shepherds don't really know what's up, they don't seem to understand that. I don't know. Do you feel like that was the case, that they didn't know how to talk to the Mahani and they just kind of left it alone and their job was to protect it? Or do you think they knew how to communicate with it?
I think it's actually a really interesting allegory if you think about it, because you have the Shepherds having so much reverence for Mahanit that they wouldn't even really go near it or set foot on it. That would be sacrilege to them. So because they hold it in such reverence and they keep such a distance from it, they're not able to learn more about it. Whereas you have Uhura that, you know, she's able to gain all that information because she got up close and met the god, so to speak, and was able to have that dialogue. And I think we've seen this at other points in Trek too, where you have like a civilization or species maybe worshiping an entity that they think has godlike powers, but really doesn't, if you break it down to science. And that's what, you know, I guess usually the crew of the Enterprise or whatever Starfleet ship figures out, that, hey, I know you guys think this is supernatural, but there's actually science here. And I think that's what you get kind of out of this dynamic as well.
Yeah, I think that's a perfect breakdown of what's going on there. It's religion to the Shepherds, it's science to the Enterprise crew. And by using science, with, like I said, within an hour or two, they're already communicating with the Mahani. So that's the difference there.
It's interesting that we bring this up again with a Pike episode, because, you know, Pike has had this sort of back and forth with between religion and science ever since the first episode of Discovery Season 2?
Second episode,
yeah. But yeah, here we're revisiting it again, yeah.
Yeah, it's kind of an ongoing theme for his character, and even, you know, what he experienced on Boreth was very spiritual. So, yeah, it's an ongoing thing for Pike. But I think it definitely helps give his character depth, and we keep on peeling back, you know, the layers of that onion, so to speak. Well, I was just going to mention how much I love our new Uhura, and I see that that's topic number two. So perfectly segue into that. I want to say this. I am just going to go on record that our strange new world Uhura blows the Kelvin universe Uhura out of the water. I just really appreciate this depiction is it Cecilia Rose Gooding? I hope I got that right. She's just knocking it out of the park, because she's sweet, she's clever, she's smart, she
She's subdued.
She's subdued. We're seeing this really early version of Uhura, Cadet Uhura, that is, you know, still finding her footing and is a little bit shy of herself and what she can do. And if you recall, I mean, in Star Trek 2009, we see Cadet Uhura as well. And she's just so much more smug, so much more sure of herself, a little bit more. They present her to be more like a badass action hero type of, you know, approach, whereas the Uhura we get here is more indicative of somebody who would be in that part of their life where they'd still be figuring it out. And I think that's what we see in Strange New Worlds.
Well, you know, for the Kelvin films, they had her, that Uhura had a different life journey, and maybe her family didn't die and whatnot. So the trajectory of her life would have been different if not for the events that had, you know, set this up for her. What I like most about it is that they tried to tie it into, you know, the actress Nichelle Nichols' own journey with Star Trek, because she started off and she was unsure whether or not she even wanted to stay, because it seemed like she wasn't getting a lot of lines or a lot of attention. And it took a visit from Martin Luther King Jr. to come to her and literally say, "We need you to do this. We need you to stay," for her to, you know, take a second look at what she was doing and come to understand it in a different way and its importance with the larger, black community in America, especially at that time in the 1960s.
Yeah, she brought a lot of representation that just was not seen. Positive representation of what a black woman could be in the future compared to what other shows were doing.
But they roped that into Uhura's backstory for Strange New Worlds, because you have her second guessing whether or not she's on the right career path, whether or not she's even going to stay in Starfleet, and they tied that together. And I just love that little nod to Nichelle, because she built this character.
And you actually see that a little bit with the way Spock is trying to say, hey, you don't realize what you have here and the opportunity that other people would kill for, what you're potentially giving up, and you bring so much value. And that could that literally could be, you know, the allegory for Dr. Martin Luther King having that conversation with Nichelle Nichols. So, yeah, I never really thought about it that way, but it's kind of spot on. I had just read a novel called Living Memory about Uhura. It's a TOS spinoff book. Came out not even a year ago, folks, Living Memory. And it takes place somewhere between the motion picture and Wrath of Khan. And it explores Uhura's backstory. And let me tell you, it's completely different than the backstory we see presented in this episode. And her mom and stepdad are very much still alive, and so are her siblings. And obviously in this version, we find out that Uhura's parents were killed before she even joined Starfleet. So, and her brother. So as much as the books are fun, you can't necessarily count on them to not be changed on live action screen. So yeah, we do see that tragedy of her, you know, that hero trope, you know, I suffered and now I'm using that suffering to overcome. You know, you mentioned to me something to the effect of, do all of our heroes need to have a tragic backstory? It's what writers do to try to make their characters more interesting.
I would argue that Uhura was already very interesting of a character without having her family, you know, die in a shuttle accident or whatever.
Oh, you don't need to make that point to me. I agree. I don't think this was necessary. And honestly, in the scene where she tells that at the dinner, it kind of is a killjoy and lets all the air out of the room. Not that people shouldn't be able to talk about their losses, but as an effect to that, it really changed the mood in the room. Mm-hmm. It was also that dinner happening at the beginning of the episode, so that the events of that dinner can affect her emotional state while on the away team mission. It's one of those clever things that we see a lot in Star Trek, where we get given this backstory in the first 5 minutes of an episode to make the rest of the episode land harder. We see that even in, you know, we get introduced to characters that die later in episodes so that we feel with the, that we care about them when they do die. Mm-hmm. I felt it was a little servicey like that, in to a certain extent. Not too much, because like I said, at the end of the day, I still give this episode like a 9.5 out of 10. I really do love this episode. I love the singing in this episode. I love the music. I think this episode, like most Strange New Worlds episodes, is just gorgeous to look at visually. Mm-hmm. It's a very, very, very gorgeous show, right down to the aliens on the planet, like you talked about, and the comet and the egg chamber. And I even enjoyed the shepherds. I know they looked a little CGI-y, but at least they looked like aliens. And they were a little bit, you know, they weren't necessarily completely human-esque as well. I mean, they did have those elements, but they had different shapes. So
yeah. Well, you get a couple of things I want to unpack there. One of the first things that you said was talking about Uhura singing. And I wanted to ask, did we see her sing in the Kelvin films? Because she definitely, if you know about Uhura from TOS, you know, first interracial kiss, and you know she sang, and you know she was a communications officer. Those are like three, like you don't even have to know Star Trek to know those three things.
Right. I mean, she even sings in Star Trek V.
That's right. I had
forgotten. I mean, all the way toward, like, you know, that was 1989, 1990 era of Star Trek. Nichelle Nichols was still singing in Star Trek then. And that was an element that they pulled in from the series into the movies.
So did they have it in the Kelvin films, though?
I don't think so. Listeners, please correct us if we're wrong. And I hope that can be maybe our little ask of the week. But I don't remember Zoe Saldana singing at all.
But casting, as you were saying, for Uhura with Celia, I think she embodies more of the essence of Nichelle Nichols that we remember from TOS.
And if you think about that, and I've seen this in interviews, I mean, like, they left it up to the actress as to whether or not she even wanted to wear a wig in the episode or just use her own hair. Episode, the series, like, you could have deliberately tried to make her look more like Uhura or like Nichelle Nichols. But they're like, no, it's this is how I look, and I'm cast, and that's good enough. I'm going to work on the essence of Uhura and, you know, that part. I think that's pretty incredible, because you're right. She does not look like Nichelle Nichols, but that's totally okay. I have bought into her as Uhura 110%.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it's about having that spirit of the character.
Yeah.
Yeah. Which I think they got right in the Kelvin films with the casting of a lot of them, like with Bones and Spock and Kirk. I mean, you couldn't ask for better. When I think of Bones, what was the actor's name that played him in the Kelvin films?
Carl Urban nails it as McCoy in the Kelvin movies.
So good.
Yes.
Yeah, because he gets that essence of the character.
Yes. Yeah. That's what it's more about.
Also, you had talked about the shepherds and the sort of bad CGI. They actually did make prosthetics. It was a person in a costume with prosthetics, and they had servos to make the head move and stuff. But I think here it kind of fell flat, where they put in all that effort to make really expensive, nice-looking prosthetics and everything. But it still came across as, to me personally, it looked like really bad CGI, which it's too bad, because they spent a lot of effort to make it look realistic, but it just, to me, it didn't. How did you feel?
Maybe not as extreme as you're feeling. I noticed it a little bit, but I also felt maybe it was a little intentional too. I don't know. It certainly did not detract from my ability to enjoy the scene or the episode. So okay. I actually thought, honestly, maybe this was something that got the kinks got worked out. I thought, you know, Pike was being a little too flippant and a little too jokey in what was a serious situation. That was a little bit more, that stood out as a little bit more out of place to me than the alien itself, because he was making jokes and him and Ortega are kind of having a little banter, and Number One as well. I just felt like, well, this is serious. We're being fired on. We have an away team down there. We have an injured crew member, and we're just cracking jokes. But it kind of goes back to the kitchen scene in the beginning. With sometimes things go so badly that all you can do is laugh. And I just probably talked myself into that why that was the way it was. So it's okay.
I like that quote, though, and it does make sense for life sometimes. Sometimes
I do.
That's all you can do.
Sometimes, you know, it reminds me of one of my favorite movies. So I'm going to take a little quick journey here, completely off the rails. So one of my favorite movies is Steel Magnolias, and that movie is mostly a comedy, dramatic comedy. But at the very end, toward the end of the movie, when Julia Roberts' character dies and her mom, played by Sally Field, is just kind of losing it, the other actresses, Olympia Dukakis and Shirley MacLaine and Dolly Parton, all kind of, it's really led by Olympia Dukakis, but they try to like break the levity of the situation with laughter by doing something so outrageous that you just have to stop and laugh. And that's what came to mind when Pike was talking about that, is that famous scene at the cemetery in Steel Magnolias. And it's true. It resonates in life. Sometimes it's just so serious you have to stop and pause and change the emotion of the moment.
Absolutely. I love that connection that you made. And just listening to you, I'm reminded of why Strange New Worlds is necessary now, why TOS was necessary in the 60s, because you had a time and a moment where we as a society are so wound up and so much animosity between each other as a society. And then you have something like this that just cuts through it. And I mean, you can say that about, you know, some of the more popular, you know, shows that have come out, like Ted Lasso has come out in the last couple of years, you know, and that's just universally loved because it's just radiates positivity and love, right? And you get that from the optimism of Star Trek. You get that, well, especially from TOS, and now from Strange New Worlds. It's a return to that touchstone of just kindness and positivity and working together to solve problems. And I think that's what Star Trek does really great. And yeah, so I love that you brought it to Steel Magnolias because, you know, that's what got me thinking about this as well.
We're not gay.
Girl.
Moving on, we talked a little bit about, should we talk a little bit about the Prime Directive and General Order 1? Because I don't think we're calling it Prime Directive yet, right? I don't think
this
so.
I think it's still General Order 1.
So
for a couple more episodes.
I think this episode also probably helps inform, like the pilot episode did, why the Prime Directive probably did become more developed and more specific, because, you know, I'm not sure. To interfere, to not to interfere, we definitely went out of our way to make sure this comet didn't hit the planet. And as far as we knew, that was a natural occurrence that was going to occur. But what makes the difference between us saving a pre-warp planet, or to say that same comet was going to hit Vulcan, and we would interfere because they have warp drive, and you know, but you could always say they were always meant to die, you know, but because they have the technology to stop it, we can stop it. But because the Persephone inhabitants don't have the technology, we're supposed to just let them die. I think the right thing was, if they could interfere without making themselves known the way they did, I was okay with it.
Do you think that that is how Picard would have handled it in TNG?
Well, that's a really good question, because we're like almost 100 years later in TNG, or 85, give or take. The Prime Directive is a little bit more specific then, but I think you'd be interfering. We've seen in more than one case where, I mean, hell, we can go back to Symbiosis. We didn't interfere there, but we knew what the answer was, you know. And I think in many cases, and I'm failing to reference one, there have been cases where we just, hey, it's not our place to interfere, and we don't. That's Mother Nature, so to speak, doing her thing.
I like you bringing up Symbiosis, because that was such a big deal for Beverly. because she wanted to break that so bad. She wanted to just get these people like off the drugs and, you know, save their society. And Picard really just wouldn't let her.
Yeah, and it was an easy fix. It was relatively, that would have been an easy way to change things for them. So, yeah, this would be a really good one for listeners, I think. Let's ask the audience that, you know, leave us some notes and some comments or hit us up on social media and the BQN Collective. Do you feel like the Prime Directive or General Order 1 was broken by interfering with the comet's trajectory? We want to hear from you.
Well, this is a good time, I think, to jump into trivia portion. So first bit of trivia we've got here. And, oh my goodness, I'm going to really try to not butcher his name, but I'm going to butcher his name, so I apologize. Despite being part of the main cast, Babs how do you pronounce that? Olasmakun. Jesus. Cannot pronounce his name.
Dr. Mbenga does not appear in this episode.
There we go.
Because we are going to be, we're going to try not to butcher his name.
Yeah.
Olasmakun. Olasmakun.
The guy from Dune. Wow. Does not appear in this episode, despite being part of the main cast. There we go.
Yeah, and well, and this is also the first episode we saw Hemmer in.
Oh, that's right. It was the introduction.
Yeah, so, yeah. We do notice that sometimes. It just, there's a week, there's just not a place for the character, and they don't put them in. Alex Kopp becomes the latest actress to portray the USS Enterprise computer voice. Previous portrayals include Majel Barrett Roddenberry, Doug Hale, who did the voice in Star Trek The Motion Picture, and Teresa Victor from Star Trek The Wrath of Khan and Search for Spock, Julianne Grossman in Discovery, and Jeanette Goldstein in Star Trek Q&A.
Yeah, I didn't realize there had been that many voices. I also didn't realize that in the motion picture there was a man's voice, so that's right. Interesting.
Yeah, and I think everyone's favorite voice and the most prevalent is Majel Barrett Roddenberry, because she basically was the computer voice for the entire Berman era.
Definitely my favorite.
Mine too.
Well, the Persephone system will later be visited by the USS Enterprise D 105 years later as the ship picks up Admiral Mark Jameson and his wife Anne from the planet Persephone. Is that 5?
Yes.
Persephone 5 in TNG episode Too Short a Season. Now, do you remember that episode? Because I saw the name of this episode and I was like, what episode is that?
Oh, that's like, I love that episode. It's like a guilty pleasure from season one. That's where Jameson comes on the Enterprise and he has to go back and deal with this hostage situation on another planet that he basically helped create years and years and years before by selling arms to basically getting involved outside the Prime Directive kind of thing. But he takes this de-aging potion that he was supposed to be taking over years to A, cure him of his disease, and B, eventually just make him younger. But because he's going on this mission, he downs not only the entire potion that he was supposed to take over time, he also takes his wife's dose, who she knows nothing about this, and he starts rapidly de-aging and becomes cured of his wheelchair in all during the episode, and eventually it kills him in the end. But it's, you know, there's that scene where they're on the bridge of the Enterprise and he's not let on that things have changed, and like he gets out of the wheelchair and goes and takes the con, and Beverly is like, he should never have walked again, and she suspects something's up, and Picard's being all nonchalant about it. And listeners, I obviously watch too much Star Trek.
There's never too much. And now that you mentioned it, I do remember that episode, and I love that episode. It's a great season one episode, and it's rare to say that about TNG, but there was a great season one episode.
Well, I figured if I just talked about it long enough, it would ring a bell. let's see here. Really interesting point as we talk about Pike's struggle through the season. It's revealed in this episode that he knows the names of the cadets that he's destined to save. And we see him look up those cadets' names on the computer and look at their childhood-type pictures mm-hmm. that are in Starfleet database before the episode is over. And he's really shook later in the season as he is introduced to one of those children.
Well, one of the children is Malik Alcazar and lives on Tendera Colony, which is the future birthplace of Annika Hansen, Seven of Nine fame, which, wow, that's a cool connection.
Yeah, it really just shows they're doing some deep notes, you know, to try to keep the universe connected.
Yeah, yeah, and it means a lot to the people that know, and if you don't know, it doesn't detract anything.
La'an postulates that Mahani may be a derelict spacecraft. 9 years later, the Enterprise would encounter a generational spaceship with the appearance of an asteroid during the events of TOS, For the World is Hollow, and I Have Touched the Sky.
I've got to rewatch that episode now, because I want to see what the ship looks like.
I was just thinking that myself. I'm like, okay, maybe that's what I'm going to be watching tonight.
Well, something that we did last week, Chrissy and I, is we had got a comment last week from @thatunsonguy on Twitter, who asked a multitude of questions of us. And rather than break down each one and address each one, it would take an entire episode. I figured we would try to address some of them in a few episodes. And this week, I want to address a question that he asked. Why does Spock not know who Khan is in Space Seed if he served with his ancestor that never stops talking about him?
That's a really good question. And I think the easy thing for me to say right now is everyone's all uptight about some of these potential issues with canon. And all I'll say is at the end of season one, we are 7 years between where we are in Strange New Worlds and the original series. So I think I don't think they're done explaining things, and we have to give the show time to breathe. And tell those stories. So I would always tell listeners to be patient, because usually at the end of the day, we get so uptight about some of these, what we consider potential plot problems, or we broke canon. And then at the end of the day, we do get there and they tie it up and it makes sense. So I hope that we do see this tied up, because it is a loose thread right now and it does not make sense. So I hear your question, listener, and I'm hoping that somewhere between season two and whenever this show runs its course or butts up against TOS, we get an explanation.
Yeah. I do know that @UnsonGuy had mentioned that he really does love Strange New Worlds and is a huge fan. That's why he has critiques. So I just want to throw that out there, fans. He does love this show. And I want to say on my end, for my headcanon, I chalk it up to the fact that I only saw her talking about it with Una. And so maybe she doesn't have like a close relationship with Spock, even though he served with her. I mean, I can't imagine Una would be a chatty Cathy about, personal things that were told to her by people working under her. So I'd imagine that Spock never found out, and he probably didn't have like a lot of social time really chatting it up with La'an. Even if they were both at the captain's table, maybe they just, the two of them, because I've been at social gatherings with people multiple times and never conversed with the same people, So that could have happened here. I don't know.
Yeah.
That's how I fix it in my headcanon.
Well, I like that. That works too. But I still think that the show is going to address it at some point.
Well, here's hoping.
Here's hoping. Yeah. I would prefer that.
Well, Christos, you got some final thoughts?
I do. Well, we do see Sam Kirk, who we've seen in the previous episode. He almost dies, and he does die in TOS. So that could be a callback or foreshadowing. I do like Sam Kirk is very impulsive character, and maybe not always the most ideal officer, as we see the few times he pops up here in season one. He gets, he gets problematic in the episode where Hemmer dies and they're on the downed ship with the Gorn on the ice planet. But I do think Sam Kirk is very cute, and I dig the mustache, so he can just carry on. Let's see. What else did we talk about? We talked about the Shepherd ship, which looks like Babylon 5. And like we said, we'll tie it back to this quote that we did kind of go off on a little bit earlier. Is, you know, remember, sometimes things go so badly, you just have to laugh. And I think that is definitely a good axiom to take through life.
Agreed. Yeah. One of my best friends, Charlie, he says to me a lot, he's like, just dance.
Yeah.
You know? And that reminds me of that a little bit. Final thoughts on this episode. It was great to jump back to the beginning of Strange New Worlds. I agree with what you said about the character growth. I didn't expect to notice that, but that's something I noticed as well, that, yeah, they do seem in these first few episodes to act one way, and then towards the end of the season, the characters have grown a little bit, and you do notice that, and especially like popping back to an early episode. They do have a lot of work to do, you know, as far as getting them from point A to point B within a 10-episode limit, but what I like about it is it doesn't feel shoehorned, it doesn't feel rushed. They're very clever. The writers in this show are very clever. I enjoy the entire journey of the season, and I'm going to continue to look for more ways, even before season 2's out, to revisit. We'll probably, on this show, revisit all of the episodes at one point or another of Strange New Worlds, because, you know, I'm a huge TNG fan, always will be. It's my Trek. Love Deep Space Nine. But I gotta say, since the 90s, this is as good as it's been.
Well, why don't you maybe plan for doing like a season one recap, kind of, you know, that'd be a kind of a good topic of the week, just to talk about the show through. Yeah, my final thoughts are very, very much along the lines of what we've already said. Like I said, I'd give it a 9.5 out of 10 on the episode itself. I think one of the reasons we do see the character growth that we both referenced is that the show allows the space for that. And where I mean that is we have these conversations at Pike's table at the end of the episodes where they're having a drink, that we've seen that on more than one occasion in the season. They allow the room for the exposition. It's like before the episode even gets going, we have some, and we allow it to bookend the episode as well, to kind of unpack some of what's going on. And because of that, we learn. And because of those areas, we do have room to comment on it throughout the episode, very much like we saw in today's. So yeah, I just love this episode. I'd watch it again today, even though I don't have the time. All right, so let's talk about next week's episode. Listeners, your homework is to watch DS9 The Assignment, because we'll be covering that as part of our Possessed series, part 4.
Absolutely, and I had actually forgotten what this episode was about, so I just did a quick Google. But evidently, it is Keiko that gets inhabited by an alien entity, and the alien entity is essentially holding Keiko's body hostage. So that should be interesting. Looking forward to that episode.
And I'm not a huge, happens.
I'm not a huge Keiko fan. Actually, she's up there with Alexander Rozenko as being one of my least favorite characters. But I remember this particular episode where I liked her in it, probably because
she wasn't being Keiko. So,
she wouldn't have been Keiko.
Yeah, I'm kind of the same way. I kind of liked Keiko a little better in TNG, but when they moved her over to DS9, not to the actress's fault at all, but they wrote the character to be like more whiny and more of a nuisance to Miles, and she just really got a bad reputation as a character because of it.
Oh, I agree with you 100%. The actress herself, whenever I see her in anything, I'm like excited. I'm like, oh, Keiko from Star Trek. But when she's on Star Trek, I'm like, oh, it's Keiko from Star Trek.
Rosalind, Rosalind Cho. Cho, yes.
Yeah.
On the spot there. Do you know, since you looked it up, what season, what episode that is?
Yes. It's the fifth episode of the fifth season.
5-5. Easy enough.
Well, we would love to hear what you thought of today's episode and hope you'll join our Facebook group, the BQN Collective, to continue our discussion there. You can also tweet your thoughts at AllGoodPod. We would love for you to reach out. We do love the interaction. So please follow the network on Twitter and Instagram at BQN Podcasts as well. So, Christos, where can people find you when you are not wandering around the desert getting surprised by a surprise monsoon?
Oh, jeez. I feel like I'm in Spaceballs. So, listeners, you can find me in the BQN Collective, also on Twitter and Instagram at GreekGeekSD. And I guess maybe I'll go out on a limb and tell listeners really quickly a little bit about that forthcoming podcast that we've been teasing all summer. So, listeners, coming to you probably in the next 4 to 6 weeks will be the first episode of What's the Tea, Bev? A new podcast brought to you by yours truly here on the BQN. We will be talking a lot about Trek news. We'll be talking a lot about speculation. And we'll also be having recurring guest hosts every week who are people I've met through the LGBTQ plus community in Star Trek, as well as allies, where we'll talk a little bit about our Trek journeys and some of our favorite things in Trek. So coming soon to a podcast near you. And so, Mark, where can people find you when you're not out worshiping Mahari?
I don't think that would be me, really. But you can find me doing other things. You can find me on the Facebook group, the BQN Collective. You can find me on Twitter at MarkWhite207. You can find me, if you become a patron of the network, on Patreon, where I host a show, It's Green. And you can find me with headphones on listening to What's the Tea, Bev? In a few weeks. So I am so looking forward to this. I can't even. I'm jumping out of my skin. It's going to be my favorite new podcast, I'll tell you already.
I'm very, very excited. So I really, I'll continue to be around, obviously, guesting here on BQN. But I really thank listeners who have been patient with me all summer as I kind of found my sea legs a little bit and gotten more comfortable in the world of podcasting and maybe found my topic, because that was part of the journey this summer, was what do I want to talk about that was going to bring something new to the BQN that's not just what you guys can get on other shows here on BQN and that already are here. So hope to bring something fresh and different. And only strengthen the lineup at BQN.
Absolutely. And it's going to be gay. Really, really gay.
That's the plan.
Well, please hit the subscribe button on Apple Podcasts or wherever you get your podcasts. And leave us a star rating and written review that helps others to find the show.
At this time, we would like to thank our executive producers who make this all possible. They are Mr. Mark White, Ms. Amy Nelson, Tony Robinson, and Ken Tripp. We'd also like to thank our associate producers, Mahendran Radhakrishnan and Tim Cooper. A special thanks to Tony Robinson for our artwork and Graham Kelly for our opening and closing music.
If you'd like to help us keep all of our shows coming to each week, you can become a patron of the network on Patreon. Join the Hive to enjoy It's Green, Amy's Math Moments, and other network perks. With a monthly subscription of $5 or more, you can join our meetings on The Hive Mind on the second Saturday of each month. Visit patreon.com/BQN to get all the details and watch your messages. Thank you for listening, and we hope you'll join us as we search out
all good things. great joy and gratitude.
Previously on BQN. All Good Things, a Star Trek Universe podcast.
Did you know G goes nowhere, does nothing? GNDN? They put that on Enterprise D doors, that abbreviation, it means, yeah, goes nowhere, does nothing.
They should have put that on this episode.
Right? Oh, dear.
Infinite Diversity, a Star Trek Universe podcast.
I saw someone on Twitter say that Pike's approach to this is the same as Edith Keeler's approach to world politics in the 30s, that it's the right idea but the wrong time for it because it won't work, because you cannot, there are some people that you cannot get peace with. Right. Some fights are inevitable, and This was one of them.
Yeah. Yeah, you can be right, but it's not always the right thing to do.
Yeah.
Galaxy Class, a Star Trek The Next Generation podcast.
Well, I just think it's feminine, but still warrior, still, you know, all the armor, but there's something flowy about it. It's just the perfect mix, you know, that fierce and feminine.
Mm-hmm.
You will find these and more of your favorite podcasts on BQN.